طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and continued in his memory by a group of his colleagues. This is John Roberts. Before we get into the substance of our program this morning, I want to tell you about an exciting exhibit that has just opened in the Multicultural Arts Center at 41 2nd Street in East Cambridge. The exhibit entitled Palestinians in Cambridge, Stories from the Diaspora, is an exhibit of photographic portraits taken by photographer Phyllis Breitholtz, along with excerpts from interviews with 21 Palestinians in the diaspora living or working in Cambridge. The exhibit is sponsored by the Cambridge Bethlehem People to People Project, a project created to provide a way for Cantabrigians to stand in solidarity with the people of Bethlehem as they resist their occupation by Israel. The exhibit highlights the stories of local Palestinians, including what happened to them or their grandparents or parents during the ethnic cleansing of Palestinian villages in 1948 and 1967, and stories of their journeys which finally end in Cambridge. The feedback from the exhibit has been enormously positive, especially from the Palestinian community. The exhibit is at the Multicultural Arts Center, 41 2nd Street, East Cambridge, until January 24th. The gallery hours are 10:30 a.m. to 6 p.m., Monday through Friday. However, this coming Thursday evening, December 12th, the gallery will be open and six of those Palestinians featured in the exhibit will have a conversation together on a special panel discussion at the gallery, beginning with some Palestinian food at 6:30 p.m., with the panel convening at 7 p.m. Come early, see the exhibit, enjoy some refreshments from the Andala restaurant in Cambridge, and hear this conversation between six of the interviewees concerning their life and travels in the diaspora. The event is free and open to the public. This week the focus has been on the death, but also the life of Nelson Mandela. Tributes flow from everywhere, citing the courageous, successful stand he took to end apartheid in South Africa. But it is difficult to hear our national leaders, in particular President Obama, cite their involvement in supporting the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa during their youth, without recognizing the power they have to end the modern equivalent of apartheid in Israel. Many object to the use of the term apartheid when it is applied to Israel, but what other word can we use to describe the structured discriminatory policies which drive the Israeli society today? One set of laws, policies, and system of benefits for Jews, and other sets for the rest, especially the Palestinian citizens, which make up 20% of the population within Israel, to say nothing of the occupation it administers in the West Bank and Gaza. What other word for this structured discrimination? Apartness? The bottom line is that it is a society based on inequality, which is not only not challenged by the United States, but is financially supported by the United States. The greatest tribute to Nelson Mandela that our national leaders could make would be to challenge the system of apartness in Israel. In tribute to Nelson Mandela, I want to read an article written by Arjan El Fassed in 2001 in the satirical style then being employed by Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, of writing mock letters from one world leader to another. Although it carries El Fasad's back byline, it has been repeatedly mistaken for an actual letter from Mandela. It is not. It is a piece of satire. Memo to Thomas L. Friedman, columnist, New York Times. From Nelson Mandela, former president, South Africa. Dear Thomas, I know that you and I long for peace in the Middle East, but before you continue to talk about necessary conditions from an Israeli perspective, you need to know what's on my mind. Where to begin? How about 1964? Let me quote my own words during my trial. They are as true today as they were then. Quote, I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and to achieve. But if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die. Unquote. Today the world, black and white, recognize that apartheid has no future. In South Africa, it has been ended by our own decisive mass action in order to build peace and security. That mass campaign of defiance and other actions could only culminate in the establishment of democracy. Perhaps it is strange for you to observe the situation in Palestine, or more specifically, the structure of political and cultural relationships between Palestinians and Israelis as an apartheid system. That is because you incorrectly think that the problem of Palestine began in 1967. You seem to be surprised to hear that there are still problems of 1948 to be solved, the most important component of which is the right to return of Palestinian refugees. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict is not just an issue of military occupation, and Israel is not a country that was established normally and happened to occupy another country in 1967. Palestinians are not struggling for a state, but for freedom, liberation, and equality, just like we were struggling for freedom in South Africa. In the last few years, and especially during the reign of the Labour Party, Israel showed that it was not even willing to return what it occupied in 1967, that settlements remain, Jerusalem would be under exclusive Israeli sovereignty, and Palestinians would not have an independent state, but would be under Israeli economic domination with Israeli control of borders, land, air, water, and sea. Israel was not thinking of a state, but of separation. The value of separation is measured in terms of the ability of Israel to keep the Jewish state Jewish, and not to have a Palestinian minority that could have the opportunity to become a majority at some time in the future. If this takes place, it would force Israel to become either a secular, democratic, or binational state, or to turn into a state of apartheid, not only de facto, but also de jure. Thomas, if you follow the polls in Israel for the last 30 or 40 years, you clearly find a vulgar racism which includes a third of the population who openly declare themselves to be racist. This racism is of the nature of, I hate Arabs, or I wish Arabs would be dead. If you also follow the judicial system in Israel, you will see there is a discrimination against Palestinians. And if you further consider the 1967 occupied territories, you will find there are already two judicial systems in operation, which represent two different approaches to human life, one for Palestinian life and the other for Jewish life. Additionally, there are two different approaches to property and to land. Palestinian property is not recognized as private property because it can be confiscated. As to the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, there is an additional factor. The so-called Palestinian Autonomous Areas are Bantustans. These are restricted entities within the power structure of the Israeli apartheid system. The Palestinian state cannot be the byproduct of the Jewish state, just in order to keep the Jewish purity of Israel. Israel's racial discrimination is the daily life of most Palestinians. Since Israel is a Jewish state, Israeli Jews are able to accrue special rights which non-Jews cannot do. Palestinian Arabs have no place in a Jewish state. Apartheid is a crime against humanity. Israel has deprived millions of Palestinians of their liberty and property. It has perpetuated a system of gross racial discrimination and inequality. It has systematically incarcerated and tortured thousands of Palestinians contrary to the rules of international law. It has in particular waged a war against a civilian population, in particular children. The responses made by South Africa to human rights abuses emanating from the removal policies and apartheid policies respectively shed light on what Israeli society must necessarily go through before one can speak of a just and lasting peace in the Middle East and an end to its apartheid policies. Thomas, I'm not abandoning Middle East diplomacy, but I'm not going to indulge you the way your supporters do. If you want peace and democracy, I will support you. If you want formal apartheid, we will not support you. If you want to support racial discrimination and ethnic cleansing, we will oppose you. When you figure out what you're about, give me a call. That was a mock letter from Arjan L. Fawcett to Thomas Friedman, columnist for the New York Times. Arjan L. Fawcett is a Dutch-Palestinian political scientist, human rights activist, and is co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. And now on to our feature presentation. This morning we will hear an interview with two women who have recently returned from a trip to Palestine sponsored by the Interfaith Peace Builders. On This Week in Palestine, we occasionally interview travelers to Palestine because we are interested in hearing from them what such a trip has had on their perception of what is going on, what life is like in the Palestinian occupied territory. The United States is a strong party in supporting the Israeli occupation of Palestine, so Americans' response to seeing and experiencing that occupation is interesting and always important to communicate to many of us who are shielded from the realities of that occupation. The two women we interviewed have differing backgrounds and approached the trip from differing perspectives. Susan Estevitz of Brookline grew up in a Jewish family with a strong Jewish identity, but with roots in the civil rights struggle. Sarah Driscoll of Jamaica Plain came to the trip as an activist who has been working on social justice issues for many years. We wanted to hear each of their responses to the trip and what an effect it has had on their lives. Here is an interview with Susan Estevitz and Sarah Driscoll. Okay, Susan and Sarah, you have recently returned from a trip to Israel-Palestine, and I'd like to talk to you about your trip. I'd like to begin by having you tell us something about yourself, how you became interested in the Israeli-Palestinian issue, why you went on this trip, how it affected you, and then we'll talk about what you saw and experienced. But let's just begin by trying to know something about you.
Hi, I'm Susan. I am a middle-aged Jewish woman. I grew up in Long Island, New York. I was somewhat religious growing up. I attended temple occasionally. And was, I think, a fairly typical American Jewish girl growing up. I supported the State of Israel. My family and I did. We contributed to Hadassah and to planting trees in Israel. And as I grew older, my interest took me to the civil rights movement and participating in VISTA, Volunteers in Service to America, and the anti-war movement, and kind of being a hippie for a part of the time in there and living in San Francisco. I came to Boston University, and majored in sociology, worked for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts as a child abuse and neglect social worker, supervisor, hotline coordinator for 35 years, and married a gentleman who had been a minister, who was on his way out of the ministry when we met, and he also went to work for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts as a social worker, and he later became an information technology person. We have five children together. My son was raised Jewish. His children are Christian. But we've managed to have all celebrations, both faiths, enjoyed them both, all. I love church. He loved temple when we went. And we loved each other's families. And it was great to have that relationship. He and I were very close. And unfortunately, about 7 years ago, he developed Alzheimer's disease. And within the last year and a half, I retired to stay home and take care of him. And then he needed institutionalization, and he went into a nursing home. And in January, he died.
Oh, dear. What brought you to be interested in this issue? How did you get in, and how did you ever end up going on a trip to Israel-Palestine?
My cousin Jane Toby, who is several years older than me, has been very interested in this issue for many years and has been talking about it. I wouldn't say it was falling on deaf ears with me, but I was not convinced or committed or ready to become involved or even to embrace it fully. Then she went to Palestine several years ago and stayed with a family in Alawaja and brought back their son, who was 28 at the time, an aspiring filmmaker. He made a movie called The Time Seller, which is about his mother going from door to door trying to sell her time. And I met him, and I really enjoyed him. He's smart, he was interesting, he was kind, he was gentle. We talked about the situation in Palestine. We talked a lot, and at some point he wanted to have a computer brought to his niece and nephew, who he wanted to have this object that he earned with his own money and wanted to bring to them. And I said that I would bring it, and I realized that I was being a little ambitious to think I could go on my own to a place I'd never been. So my cousin suggested that I look into Interfaith Peace Builders, which I did. And applied, even though they said the deadline had passed. I was thinking, oh, maybe I won't get to go. Kind of ambivalent. Oh, that'll be relief if they don't let me go. But they did, and I went.
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history.
Wonderful. Sarah.
Yes.
Sarah. I know you've been working on this issue for a while, but you decided to go.
Yes. So I got turned down to I've been active in politics for years and years and years, you know, 40-something years. I ended up getting involved in after the first Intifada with Women in Black through some women here in Boston, and got involved in the issue at that time. So that was in the early 90s, so like 23 years or something. And I always wanted to go. Between work and finances, it just never seemed to be happening. I'm now retired. And I was committing myself to do some kind of travel. And within a minute, practically a day or two, this email came about Interfaith Peace Builders delegation happening, and I was like, I'm in. So that's, and Olive Harvest had been something I'd wanted to do when B2P still existed, Boston to Palestine, which was the group that hosted people to, you know, or helped people get over to do olive harvesting. I had wanted to go back in the 90s, early 2000s, and then that organization kind of fizzled, and that option became not, and because I liked it, the way I like to travel is to do work while I'm there. I always, wherever I am, I'm not a great just straight up tourist traveler. So that's how I went to Central America and Cuba and whatnot, is to do work while I'm there. And so this, I thought, oh, olive harvesting, we'll do some work, and that would be great. So that's how I ended up going.
So did you find that when you finally were able to go, did you, was it as you thought it would be, or was it different? What happened? What experiences did you have, and how did it affect you?
I was feeling like I had a pretty strong understanding of what was going on, which I did. I mean, I had seen probably a bazillion movies and heard tons of report backs and speakers, and thought I had a grasp until I got there. And it was mind-boggling how bad it is and how horrible it is. I feel like I even went up to my colleague, Nancy Murray, and I just was saying, and I've been working with her in Boston Coalition for Palestinian Rights for many years now, 8 to 10 or whatever, and I was like, I just am blown away. She said, really? I thought you... I said, no, I hadn't been here, you know, I hadn't seen it, and it just is not letting go. As I've returned, during the 2 weeks there, I just listened and listened and listened and listened so hard and looked and looked and took over 400 photographs. And I can't let it go now. I mean, it's been a month, practically, since we've been back. And I think about it constantly. And every single thing I do, it comes up in some way or another about what the situation is for the Palestinians. So it's changed me.
Susan, for you, this must have been quite an experience as someone who grew up as a religious Jew and whose family is probably quite pro-Israeli, I would think. How did this affect you?
It was probably, as Sarah said, it was an incredibly life-changing experience. I didn't have the background. I didn't know as much as most of the people who went, but I must say it is a shock to see the devastation of people's homes. Do you want me to talk about that now, or did you want to wait?
Sure,
later?
No, go. Just...
You know, we saw a man whose house, a family whose house had been demolished for maybe the fifth time. They tried to rebuild. He and his daughter, his 5-year-old daughter, were on the street. They were speaking with us. He was such a kind, gentle man, and explaining, you know, he just wants to live. He just wants to have a home for his family. I think he had 5 or 6 other children. It had been a family home in their family for generations. They were down to this, what was left to them was a cave. Literally, a cave. He took us inside. 8 people slept in the room he took us into. And his daughter, she didn't have a smile to be found. She was just...
traumatized.
Numb. Yeah. Just totally numb. That was just... and not to say it was just one of many, but it was one of many experiences that we had. So many people. All people who said, you know, that they just want to live. They want to be able to take care of their children, to have enough water. to be able to move about, to work, to love, to live, to laugh, to just have a life. I mean, I've seen poverty before, and it's never pretty, but this was just devastating. The way the roads cut off the people from their farmlands.
The wall.
The wall.
These are the bypass roads. These are the roads on which only Israelis can go.
Yellow license plates.
The yellow license plates, and Palestinians cannot go on those roads.
That neighborhood that Susan's referring to is Silwan, which is a neighborhood right in Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, right next to the old city. And the Israelis are claiming it as the city of David. They're saying that's where the city of David was, and therefore they have to cleanse the neighborhood so that they can put in a basically almost a theme park around the city of David. And this is like a very deep valley kind of with two high hills.
And historically an Arab village.
Very historically a Palestinian village. So it was pretty devastating that folks had to carve their way into the side of the hill to live after their house had been demolished up on top of the hill.
Because they're clearing the land for this.
They're clearing the land. Yeah. And they're not saying it's eminent domain. They're saying cleansing. They're using the word cleansing as opposed to the other kinds of demolitions, which are, you know, you're not permitted to build.
Right.
Because you can't get a permit. Because it's 0.03% of people are allowed a permit every year. And if you even can do that, it's at 30,000 shekels. So, you know, it's a lot of money. And so most people can't afford it. And yet they're constricted by the wall, so they can't expand in any way. Families can't grow or can't move out. So it's this draconian, Orwellian kind of existence of everywhere you turn, there is a blockade, whether it's a physical blockade of the wall or another blockade of a rule or a law or the Israeli army. You know, and I hesitate to ever call it a defense force because we know they're not defending anything. It's an offensive force. So it was just really remarkable to experience that over and over in every aspect of the country. And we did get up north to Jenin and down south as far as Hebron. We got into the Negev and met with some Bedouin right before this power plant. We were in Ramallah. We were kind of really all over. We did get to Tel Aviv for an afternoon of meetings.
Nazareth,
We were in Nazareth. Oh, yeah.
Nazareth.
Yes, and Nazareth Elite.
Yeah.
We got up into it. Jonathan Cook took us around.
Oh, wonderful.
So that was lovely. He was fantastic, and we met his amazing wife also, who has started a new women's organization to help women create their own businesses of being hostels and for travelers, providing housing and food. So it's a little business that all these women are, that she's helping women create. So that was great. We actually went to one for lunch. It was, but I just want to just say also the joy and the love that we were given by Palestine. We stayed in two Palestinian homes, and in one is in, for me, it was in Anin, right outside of Jenin, for the Olive Harvest Festival. We went to a fantastic festival celebration with dance and cultural and music, and it was wonderful. A whole community came together of olive farmers. Mm-hmm. And at the Canaan Center, which is an olive farmers cooperative. And then we also stayed, we went to Bilin, down south, where the peace demonstrations have been for the last however many years.
Every Friday
for what, 8 years or something, and the film Five Broken Cameras was made there. So we stayed with families there, and all of them thank us profusely for coming. And, you know, we thank them profusely for hosting us with, I mean, it was just incredible. So it was a really, and lots of laughter. There was plenty of laughter and joy, and with children, we had a lot of fun in that way, but also learned a tremendous amount. So
tell me about, I understand you had an interesting first day.
Oh, yeah.
in Bethlehem. Tell us about your orientation to...
well,
to the West Bank.
We arrived in our tour bus to...
Which had Hawaii on the side.
Oh.
Right. Right, a big, luxurious, lovely tour bus with the best tour guide and a wonderful driver who managed to save us from a lot of near misses because the roads are so narrow and steep and the bus is so big. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we arrived at the Ida refugee camp. And
in Bethlehem.
In Bethlehem. Yeah. And as we pulled up, we saw these two young boys, maybe 8 and 6, two boys in the street throwing stones near the refugee camp. They were absolutely not throwing stones at anything. There was nothing really to throw stones at. They were just in the street playing like kids do. Any mm-hmm. kids. We also saw up on a hill quite a number of feet away, a
couple blocks,
a block or so away, Israeli soldiers guarding a settlement.
So this was on the other side. This was on the other side of the wall from the camp, or
no? We were in the camp.
You were in the camp.
We were,
yes, but they were up by the settlement.
No, yeah. they were just oh. two streets. They were on the main drag.
Okay.
In front of La G.
Yeah.
Which I don't know the name of the street. And
so
then they were just 2 blocks
ahead.
Up
oh,
right
okay.
there.
So, okay, got it.
So half of us got out of the bus without incident. And then as the rest of us were getting out of the bus, including me, they detonated a tear gas canister. And I didn't know what hit me. I thought I had no idea. It was awful. I thought I was going to die. My tour leader, Jacob Pace, I think, pushed me in the building. And I thought that I was having a heart attack. I couldn't see. My chest hurt. And I said, I'm going to die here in this place today. Of course, I didn't, thank God. And it cleared up within a few minutes. But we were told, and I know, that this happens many times a day, a week, that they also detonated one that was for us when we were, well, for us. Some of us got it when we were leaving. I didn't get hit that time, but those of us who hadn't gotten hit in the first place got it the second time. And these kids, you know, they couldn't have, there was no reason. It was mind-blowing. I think it was a really excellent first event because nothing could have been clearer. Mm-hmm. There was no danger to anybody whatsoever, except from the Israeli soldiers.
So life in Ida camp, right?
Ida camp.
Yeah.
Yes, rudely awakened. Mm. The thing that's also interesting was that I forgot. So.
Okay. Talk a little bit about Hebron. What's unique about Hebron?
I'll talk about Hebron because I can't remember the name of the film several years ago about Hebron and the installing of settlers more and more and more in the buildings above the Palestinians mm-hmm. up on the second and third floors of different buildings and in the Souk area too. And it was, and I had seen like the film telling us about, you know, Israeli soldiers standing around while settlers would throw junk and trash and garbage and
from up above down onto the street and into the marketplace,
but also would come down and actually push children and mm-hmm. women and were physically. I mean, and the soldiers would just stand by. So I had heard and seen about Hebron, and I really wanted to go there. I wanted to see, and we got a really amazing tour there. We went to, of course, that's the place where the Church of the Patriarchs is,
right.
Or the burial ground of the Patriarchs. So we actually went there, and we went to the synagogue side, and we went to the
Muslim
side, and they were very different, which is another whole story. But and then we got a tour of the neighborhood where the Palestinians, well, if you want to call it living, that's where they live, but they're not allowed to have any cars at all. Many of the houses are vacated and empty. We went up to a checkpoint. There was a soldier there. And the guy who was guiding us, again, I don't remember his name. I have it, of course, written down. Mm-hmm. who has been arrested like 40 times. And the soldiers were standing at the checkpoint, and we wanted to go through into the other side, and they were asking for IDs, and he said, well, you don't ask the settlers for their IDs. And they said, oh, yes, we do. I always ask them for them IDs. He goes, you absolutely do not ask them. You cannot ask them. It's against the law to ask the settlers. And, of course, immediately right then, some settlers came by and were going through. And of course, he never asked them for their IDs because he cannot do that. And so what impressed me most was not that he was a little liar or anything about that, was the complete confidence that our guide had. Gosh, I wish I could remember his name. Asa, I think. Kept just, you know, provoking and talking and being very direct and very confrontative.
Isa. Amro.
Yeah, thank you very much. Asa, Isa. And so he was quite amazing. And then we took a walk through the souk. Mm-hmm. And it was just unbelievable because, of course, they've now taken to hanging fencing all along the top of it so that and it's loaded with trash from the settlers throwing things down on people. Mm-hmm. And
now is the souk the marketplace, is it still quite desolate?
Yes. Lots of parts of it. But tell them what happened to you there.
Oh.
Was that where you ran into?
Yeah, that's okay. I was there walking with my group in a big hurry, as usual, rushing mm-hmm. through the souk, and I saw a gentleman that I thought was my cousin, and it turned out he is my cousin, Peter von Achtmehl. He's a filmmaker, and he was there with his girlfriend, who was also the camera woman, and they were filming in that area.
Just by chance he was there?
Yeah,
so you were there and he's there filming?
There, yeah.
In Hebron?
Yes.
Amazing.
He's an award-winning photographer and filmmaker.
And in Hebron. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
I was going to mention in Hebron that we went to
David Wilder.
See David Wilder, who was the publicist for Beit Hadassah. Mm-hmm. Beit Hadassah is a settlement. And he spoke with us. He had a gun. He's a very religious man. He had all the...
He's from Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. And...
Sounds right.
You know, as the session went on, he became increasingly more defensive. With every question that we asked, his level of anger kind of...
Increased.
Mm-hmm. And he basically feels that they're the ones living in a ghetto. The Israelis are the ones living in the ghetto. And that they have to protect themselves from the terrorists who are the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And he seems very firmly committed to that proposition. And it was really discouraging. Really discouraging. Most of the people we met were Palestinians. We met him, and then we met with three young Israelis.
And we also met with the woman in Sderot.
Yeah, that was a good experience.
Yes. Oh, you mean the not good experience.
Yeah.
The three young Israelis in Jerusalem, yeah. They came to our hotel. Student, one was had been a student when first connected with IFPB, mm-hmm. Interfaith Peace Builders, had been a student, now was a professor, you know, a young professor. And he brought his sister and his sister's friend, who was recently made Aliyah from Argentina to Israel. And the young women, I asked a question about the military service and what they experienced in there and what they saw. And both of them were in the intelligence division and were nowhere near the West Bank, really, in that regard. So they didn't have anything to talk about. So they were really within the really classic tradition of feeding the party line about Israel and everything. And our room, we started out, it was, all of us were there, we started out, there was an openness in the room. We tried, you know, But as they spoke, there was, you could feel the room getting hotter and closing in, and everybody feeling very much uncomfortable because they really have no clue.
And very sad, because these are
youngsters,
young folk who were supposed to be more on the liberal side of things,
19.
Which is why they're meeting with us, you know. And it was so clear that they're so far away from any understanding of reality on the ground there.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was in they came
into Jerusalem.
East Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Which they can do with impunity, you know.
Yeah.
Get a Palestinian to go to West Jerusalem, it might be another story.
Right, right. And so you were in the West Bank. You also went into Israel. You went to Nazareth. And tell me, in the few minutes we have, about going to Sderot and what that is and where that is and what's going on there.
Okay, well, it's the town in the south of Tel Aviv, just outside of Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
It's north of Gaza. And it's the one that you hear about a lot, where the Qassam rockets from Gaza go into the city. And we met with an Israeli peace activist there. And she was quite remarkable. She really talked a lot about having had been felt like when the rocketing was really intense.
Mm-hmm.
She came there in the 50s, and she talked about what an open community it was, and what a really diverse community it was of Moroccan Jews and all kinds of, I mean, it was like very kind of an artsy community, actually, and was the impression I got. And she said it was a very open, lovely community. And so she started talking about the experience being really quite frightening, and how the Israeli government then started moving in the new members of the society, and that was mostly the Russians, and who they are also installing in a lot of the settlements.
Right.
And so they were kind of using it as a settlement setting. You know, again, moving people in who are poor, who really needed to have housing, who would accept to be kind of moved wherever they were allowed to go, you know, to get what they... And so she said the energy in the city changed considerably because of that, and also, but that she talked a lot about the psychology of being under siege,
mm-hmm.
you know, by the Qassams, mm-hmm. which, you know, just these little rockets. I mean, let's not talk about overhead bombing like the Israelis do in Gaza, you know.
Yeah.
So she, but it was quite moving, and then talked about how they felt they needed to reach out, and they wanted to talk to the Gazans, and they wanted to talk to Hamas, and they wanted to really make connection. Especially the older group of people who had been there longer and didn't want to feel this level of hostility and wanted to make peace. And they did connect somehow, and but they could never meet each other, of course, because they couldn't cross any boundaries.
Couldn't get into Gaza.
They couldn't get into Gaza, couldn't get out to them. So what they did was take cell phones and put them in the middle of a room in each location and sit around in a circle and have meetings and discussions via cell phone, and two different groups of, you know, people. It was quite intriguing.
Now, you were not able to get into Gaza?
We didn't try. It wasn't
okay.
on the agenda.
Yeah. Yeah, it's...
And I think they were supposed to have, IFPB was supposed to have another delegation go to Gaza, that, in fact, they had to cancel because they were not going to be able to get in.
Well, this has been wonderful. What's the take on this now? You're back here, and is this changing at all the way you're conducting your life here, or what you're going to be doing in the face of this
For me,
trip?
It definitely
is
changing my life.
Mm-hmm.
I have made to myself a commitment that this is going to be the focus of what I do with my time and energy going forward. I've begun to be involved with Jewish Voice for Peace, and I'm just going to do what I can as issues present themselves to me, and find a niche in some way, I hope. But this is where my interests lie, and I want to devote myself to this cause.
Wonderful.
Yeah, just quickly, BDS, 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 which is what we heard from everyone over there, both the Israeli side and the Palestinian side, all encouraged BDS, please participate. And I have been doing that around the homeless campaign here in Boston.
Yeah, boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
Exactly, right. Boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So we met with Omar Barghouti, and he gave a wonderful presentation in Ramallah. And
he's the one that he's the
he wrote the book
he's
on
the father
BDS.
Of,
he wrote the book on
BDS,
literally
Palestinian out of Ramallah.
Yes,
right.
He is. So that's what I'm going to continue to do, and I feel like as much as I can do, I will do. I'm also hooking up with JVP and kind of, you know, not membership wise or whatever, but necessarily, but I go to their events, and so that was the other thing. Many people there knew about JVP. Mm-hmm. Both Israeli and Palestinian, and talked about JVP and hooking up with them and the work that they do. So, which I had done already
yeah.
prior to leaving. Mm-hmm. So I've been involved with the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions campaign since the beginning here in Boston, and I will redouble my efforts.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both. It sounds like an amazing trip, and as one who went through the experiences you went through, I didn't really know until I went, and it's a transforming experience, and I certainly would encourage anyone that can possibly go on one of these trips to do so.
I would too, and I just want to quick say about IFPB, Interfaith Peace Builders, is an incredibly together group of people who lead wonderful delegations, and I really encourage people get online and look up ifpb.org. and check them out. And Interfaith Peace Builders. And they're based in Washington. It's only 4 people mm-hmm. on the staff, and they are remarkable.
How many trips a year do they have? Do they...
Two or three, depending.
Or three. Yeah.
And they focus them differently. And there is one trip that actually it also focuses on with folks of African heritage. Mm-hmm. So that's also a really great thing.
Great.
So that's a great way to go in a delegation setting like that.
Well,
thank you, John.
Susan and Sarah, thank you for sharing this with us on This Week in Palestine. And we wish you best wishes and much luck in dealing with this intractable issue. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was an interview with Susan Estevitz and Sarah Driscoll, who have recently returned from a rather transformative trip they took to Palestine with the organization Interfaith Peace Builders. And that is it for This Week in Palestine. Please join us every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. for news, analysis, and commentary from the Palestinian perspective. This Week in Palestine is a segment of Truth and Justice Radio. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.